Good morning and welcome to Spotlight on Industry. I'm your host, Sam Mason. This morning we wrap up our four-part series on alternative, sustainable, and clean energy by presenting part two of our tour of the Cooper Nuclear Station in Brownville, Nebraska. If you missed part one, you can go back and listen to it on our website at kxcv.org and then click on the link that says Programs. One of the highlights of our time at the nuclear station was a roundtable discussion with all the managers and directors of the facility about the evolution of safety in not just this plant, but in all nuclear facilities in the United States. So we'll bring you the highlights of that discussion. In the second half of the show, we'll take you to the very top of the facility where we actually stood directly above the reactor vessel and peered down into the spent fuel pool. We've got a lot to cover in today's program, so stick around as we shine the spotlight on industry.
Support for Spotlight on Industry on KXCV KRNW comes from Nottoway County Economic Development. Coordinating economic development services for the City of Maryville, Nottoway County, and the Maryville Industrial Development Corporation. Their services include finance and incentives development, site location, industrial development, and small business assistance. More at MarylandMO.org. And from Mazingo Lake Recreation Park. The park features the Seacrest 18 Golf Course and the Watson 9 Executive Course opening this May. More information about Mazingo's golf offerings and tee times is available at MazingoLake.com. Support also comes from the City of Maryville, Missouri, offering residents and visitors opportunities in education, employment, health care, and recreation, as well as agricultural, industrial, retail, and professional services. More information about the City of Maryville is at www.maryville.org.
Once again, good morning and welcome back to Spotlight on Industry. If you're just joining us, this month we are wrapping up our series on alternative, renewable, and clean energy. Last month, we brought you part one of our tour of the Cooper Nuclear Station in Brownville, Nebraska. In that program, we learned how their boiling water reactor harnesses the power of the atom to create electricity. We also took an extensive look at the importance of safety within the plant with a tour of their simulator. This month, we'll dive a little deeper into safety by having a roundtable discussion about three infamous nuclear incidents and how they changed the industry. In our time at the Cooper Nuclear Station, we couldn't help but be struck by the emphasis on safety at the plant. Not just the safety of the workers, but more so, the safety of the public. There are so many layers of safety in place at our country's nuclear facilities that the likelihood of an accident that would cause a public health concern is beyond minuscule. However, there is a specter that hovers over the industry and it just won't go away. When I mention the names Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima, there's probably one word that comes to mind: disaster. In the court of public opinion, these events have left an indelible mark on the public's view of nuclear safety. Truth be told, they have indeed left an indelible mark on the industry, but it's a good mark. The incidents at Three Mile Island, or TMI as you'll hear it called, as well as Chernobyl, were solely due to operator error. The accident at Fukushima was due to a 10-meter-high tsunami wave that was the result of an earthquake. There was no damage to the facility as a result of the earthquake itself, but how do you anticipate a 10-meter-high wall of water? Well, the upshot of these incidents and accidents has resulted in stringent rules, regulations, and procedures to prevent them from happening in the future. I sat down with a number of officials from the Cooper Station to talk about these incidents and the changes that they have brought upon the industry. Joining me in the room were NPPD's Vice President and Chief Nuclear Officer, Oscar Limpius, Operations Manager, Dan Goodman, Director of Engineering, Dan Buman, System Engineering Manager, Khalil Dia, Turbine Generator System Engineer, Kyle Helgenfeld, and Communication Coordinator, Drew Niehaus. The first voice you'll hear is that of Vice President, Oscar Limpius. Interestingly, his first day on the job as a structural engineer was at a nuclear facility in San Francisco. But ironically, that was the day of the Three Mile Island incident.
When did the United States really earnestly begin building nuclear power plants?
In the 50s, after they were doing nuclear testing, and they discovered that we could produce energy with reactors in that time period.
Okay. And you've been in the industry since 1979. Correct.
I started my career the day of the TMI accident.
That's the Three Mile Island incident. Okay. That was your first day on the job?
That was my first year, my first day as a structural engineer in San Francisco. And that company was actually in the process of building the majority of the new reactors in the state. I joined the company as a structural engineer.
How did incidents like Three Mile Island and like Chernobyl and even more recently Fukushima, what impact has that had on the industry?
Well, if you look at TMI for us was an eye-opener when it came to process improvements and also our training program. We kind of, in the 70s, the training program for operators was not as strong as it is today. It would take 6 months to get a reactor operator license. Now it takes 2 years. We also, at the time of TMI, we started the Institute of Nuclear Power Operation, which is in Atlanta, IPO. And we all participated in that. They keep the nuclear industry on the watch. They are the oversight organization for the nuclear. TMI happened because of lack of procedures, lack of knowledge, and it was a very, very expensive learning for the nuclear industry. At the time that I was a structural engineer, we were building Limerick in Pennsylvania, and that plant went from two units for about $800 million. By the time we retrofit everything, it became like $2.6 billion.
I think one thing that our listeners would be interested to know is maybe tell us a little bit about what happened at Three Mile Island. For myself, I was 13 years old when that happened. I remember it being in the news. I remember it being an incident, but never really got an understanding of exactly what was entailed in that.
Okay. I was a brand new kid out of college when the accident happened. And then in 1997, I became engineering director at TMI, the unit that is running. What happened at TMI, they were doing some testing, and in the middle of the test, the operator didn't realize that a component was open, and it was left open, and it actually, the water level decreased dramatically that exposed the core. And that produced a meltdown, that they call it. And basically, the inside of the reactor, all the fuel got damaged beyond repair. Since then, we have improved our processes, procedures, training, emergency preparedness. There was, you look at in the 70s, we didn't have emergency preparedness.
We didn't have simulators.
We didn't have
emergency procedures.
Yeah. We didn't have the involvement from the community for evacuating people.
Yeah.
So a lot of changes, but it was an operator that wasn't paying attention to a piece of equipment. He thought it was open. It was closed, but in reality, it was open. The water came out. It contaminated the whole area. So.
And that, of course, was at a time when nuclear power was, I won't say in its infancy because you said it started in the 50s, but let's call it in its adolescence. But it a certain stigma to nuclear energy that I think still is maybe prevalent today. Is that true or is that a false statement?
Well, certainly, you know, it's a very efficient way and a very economical way to be able to make electricity. But you always have to have respect for it. And so no different than the risks that you would see at a lot of different items. It comes inherent with it, with certain risks that have to be managed. And that's what we're all talking about here is the management of those risks. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's the work control process, whether it's the training, whether it's the equipment. You know, there was a lot of, out of Three Mile Island, there was a lot of investments into the facilities and upgrades of equipment, upgrades to the training, you know. So the whole piece was put together then as far as what we needed in improvements into safety systems to make sure that, you know, we always look at it and analyze what's the worst thing that could possibly happen, and then we always make sure we have barriers in place to keep that from going.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we've been talking about in this series that we're doing is, like I said, alternative energy, clean sources of energy. And is nuclear, by and large, a zero emissions form of generating electricity?
We are completely carbon free from discharges. We have zero discharges.
Zero discharges through the river.
Through the river. Everything is monitored. Give you some sort of idea of the level that we monitor. You know, we did modifications to our station batteries that we have here, and when we did that, they're very large batteries. You always have the problem of acid spill. We got some potash from one of our coal plants that we decided to bring here in the case to be able to help neutralize it if we had a spill. We brought that on in here. We went to try to get it back off site. We measured the radioactivity, and just the natural radioactivity was too high, and we could not release it back off the site. So we had to discharge it as a radiological hazard because it had physically come onto here. So we monitored to very, very low levels to be able to make sure that we have zero risk out to the public and that we have zero emissions.
Now, when we talk about radioactivity, you know, we probably manage the risk better than anybody in the world when it comes to nuclear. If you compare, for example, a plant that does create chemicals, I mean, you go to Louisiana outside Baton Rouge, outside New Orleans, there's a lot of chemical plants. They produce stuff for agricultural purposes, mm-hmm. You know. We manage risk better than anybody else. Our systems are managed and we monitor the performance of every piece of equipment here 24/7, 365 days. So from the risk aspect, I think nuclear manage risk better than anybody else.
As a matter of fact, Sam, the oil industry, the offshore oil rigs, as that industry, they were looking at the nuclear industry and doing some benchmarking because our safety record as an industry is phenomenal. And they wanted to transfer our safety standards to that industry.
Okay.
Yeah. And we did talk about risk, but also when you look at the plant equipment, I'm sure you went out there and looked at it. We have a preventive maintenance program. All our equipment is maintained. So he's a turbine engineer. He's responsible for the whole turbine. We have inspection frequencies that we go inspect and we go repair and we go and replace over time. So we maintain our equipment, not only from a risk perspective, it's for reliability for the plant to stay, to stay in a safe fashion. So when the operator needs that equipment, it's ready for him to be able to utilize that. So that's how we manage the plant itself. So we spend a lot of time and effort on maintaining the equipment.
Okay. So, you know, of all the things that I'm learning about nuclear from the research that I've done in preparation for this story, from visiting with Drew, from visiting with you guys, I'm not really seeing the downside to nuclear, but it seems like when you turn on the radio, you turn on the television, you know, you see maybe stories about how it's time for you to get rid of spent fuel. You're going to put that on a train, and states are saying, no, you're not bringing that through my state. I don't want that. But it sounds to me like it's something that's actually very safe. So what is it about nuclear that scares us as Americans, I guess?
I believe, in a way, it's education. I'm from Bolivia, originally, and they just announced in Bolivia they're going to build a nuclear facility for research projects. And the first thing that comes in the picture, we don't want no nuclear in Bolivia. Well, you don't understand. I mean, people need to be, it's a matter of education. When I work at TMI, you know, people will come and tell me, how can you go there when this radiation come on the cooling tower? Well, that's not true. That white cloud that you see out of the cooling tower is the cleanest water steam that you can see. So to me, it is in a way, we need to start by educating from childhood to adulthood what the nuclear industry does, and it has. It is a perception. It's a perception that you know, because of the consequences. But the people need to understand that the safety system, the backup system, the training that we go here seven days a week, the risk, how we manage the risk. We are talking about the probability of 10 times to the minus 7 compared to a plant that produced batteries in India that killed 200 in an explosion, or the plant in Bangladesh, or the plant even outside the New Orleans that produced chemicals. It's a perception that it requires a lot of communication and a lot of education. I think that makes a big difference.
Yeah. And when you look at Chernobyl, I'm sure the event for Chernobyl did not help anybody either. When you look at the regulations and the controls they have there compared to ours, ours is totally different. You know, at Chernobyl, one individual was doing testing and lost control of that reactor. In the United States, you cannot do any testing. You got to have a procedures, you got to have evaluations, you got to have controls in place before you go operate the system. So there's a huge difference between the two. So
even between Fukushima and Cooper, which are the model of the plant, the style of the plant is very similar. However, there was a lot of things that we had already improved on. Nuclear power, the other piece about nuclear power and managing of risks is we're continuously learning. We're always trying to gather new information and improve and put more safety and put more margin into there. So when you look at things at in Fukushima, we had from even non-nuclear events such as 9/11 when that occurred, there was a variety of things that occurred around this plant, and looking at how do we protect and make sure. We had protection prior, we have more protection, but always looking at what do I have to do for mass casualty sorts of things. Had they put some of those things in place over in Japan prior to that, some of the severe accident management guidelines and some of the other things that we would have been doing, they were doing a lot of things on the fly that we already had pre-camp. Now, with that stated, there's a lot of lessons learned, and we're applying those here and increasing that into our design. We're doing additional training. We're doing from emergency preparedness, you know, on the drilling of the teams to make sure that we're always prepared and always ready to manage the risk, always try to prevent the incident from occurring, but in the event that it did, always be able to minimize that and manage that.
Does the United States really lead the way in terms of nuclear safety?
Yes. We are much, much more conservative than anybody else.
Okay.
When it comes to security and safety of it, we are very aggressive, and because of that, sometimes it gets to be very expensive. But we are ahead of it in the state. Our regulations, the way we you know, I'm the chief nuclear officer of Cooper, so. We are 29 chief nuclear officers in the country that manage the nuclear business. We all align, we all work together, we all solve our problems together. You don't see that too often in other countries. I mean, I've been in Japan, I've been in Europe, I've been in Korea, I've been in Taiwan, even Mexico or Brazil, and it's not the brotherhood, if you want to call it, the union that we have, where we all make decisions to protect the public together, and we move forward with the actions. Once we agree, there's no question asked. You don't see that too often in anywhere else. So yeah, we are much more tied in solving issues here.
I mean, as an example, I got the responsibility for plant reliability. A system engineering manager. We do once a year, all system engineering managers for all the nuclear facilities, we meet in Atlanta. We all get together to share the lessons learned. We look at what they're doing better than us so we can learn from it. We share our issues so they can go design the plant, or they can put things in place, they can protect their plant. So we share a lot of info between all of us. Mm-hmm. That is really the difference between us and outside United States. We're willing to share that info and willing to help each other so we can get better.
You know, really simply put, there's no such thing as plagiarism in the nuclear industry. If somebody is doing something well, we want everybody to do it well, and we share that information open and fluidly.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and this might be a stretch for a statement, but based on what you're telling me about safety in the United States versus other plants or other countries. The last nuclear incident that happened or accident that happened would have been Fukushima, and that was triggered by an earthquake. So if there are nuclear plants in other countries, and maybe they're not as well regulated as ours are, that it must still be relatively safe because you don't ever hear of incidents that are happening, unless you don't hear about those incidents. But if there were some sort of a meltdown in another country, it would certainly be world news. So I guess it seems like a safe statement to say that nuclear is very safe, even in a worst-case scenario country that doesn't monitor it as closely as the United States. Am I off base on that?
I'll tell you another thing, just to add to that. The Fukushima issue actually has brought the whole nuclear industry closer. Mm-hmm. You know, we
have... Worldwide.
Yeah, worldwide. We are working very close with Japan. We are very close with Europe.
Mexico.
Mexico. So that the results of Fukushima have really helped the industry worldwide to get closer in solving issues together, which makes it, you know, more important than that we are protecting the safety of the public in a way that everybody's going to be playing in the same sandbox.
But back to your original point of inherent within the design is built into safety, multiple layers of safety. And we are, just like Fukushima was, we are analyzed for earthquakes and tornadoes and any sort of natural events that could occur. They were also, but they what actually happened is the earthquake really didn't cause the problem as much. It was, you know, they survived the earthquake quite fine.
The earthquake, I was in Japan when the accident happened. I went to visit the plant and we took a tour. The earthquake didn't cause nothing. There was no damage at the plant. The water didn't happen. Because after the earthquake happened and they waited like 9-10 minutes when they got the alarm of the tsunami. So if you look around the results of the earthquake, there was a couple of tanks that were bent a little bit, but there was no equipment damage because they were designed for a strong earthquake. So are we designed for the maximum earthquake that we have in the study that we have done? But they missed the tsunami because they knew they had tsunamis before, but this was the tsunami. Mm-hmm. So that was a little different. So
yeah. I mean, the biggest difference for Fukushima would have been the emergency response organization. If they would have had that, it would have helped them mitigate the condition they had, right?
In some cases.
Yep.
I know we have just a couple more minutes, so I wanted to talk just a little bit again, going back to kind of that shift toward clean energy, alternative energy. When I think of, I guess, alternative energy, I think of, you know, wind as a source. You think of solar as a source. Is nuclear power considered an alternative form of energy? I mean, it's certainly a clean form of energy, but is it what people would consider an alternative form of energy?
I don't know if that's technically a fair assessment. Mm-hmm. Nuclear plants are designed to be what's considered a baseload plant. Once we flip the switch and turn back on from a refueling outage and are putting power out to the grid, ideally we want to go up until our next refueling outage without any incidents and never have to come offline. You don't necessarily have that with some of your other sources that are considered alternative energy. Case in point, if the wind isn't blowing, you're not getting power from wind turbines.
You don't have sun, you don't have solar.
But we're here 365 days a year. We do a refueling outage, and then we operate for 2 years, basically 100% power, the entire time frame, and producing that energy. So it is a base load, always dependable, always there. We're able to provide voltage control for the grid. All of these items that some of these alternatives that come and go can't.
Within the energy industry, is there ever a time that we see where these alternative forms of energy, such as solar, such as wind, nuclear not necessarily being alternative, but do we ever see a time where all these forms of energy overtake coal and gas as the primary source of generating electricity in the United States?
I don't think that you will ever see another coal plant built in the United States just based on the political climate. And I really do think that's fair to say, but as far as nuclear, there is new nuclear being built. You know, we are pursuing that as a country. There's a lot of plants that are converting old coal plants into natural gas plants. So I think in one of the recent State of the Union addresses, the president used the term all of the above. I really think that you're going to have that in the United States as to what level, what everything will be. That's going to vary on the political climate. But I think there will always be a place for nuclear. On some level, I think there will always be a place for coal, natural gas. You're going to have steady, reliable sources of generation. Your fossil plants, steady and reliable. You flip a switch, they turn on. You don't necessarily have that luxury with hydro or solar or wind. You have it with nuclear. And for steady, reliable energy, you're always going to need those plants.
What are the final things that you would like for our listeners to know about not only nuclear energy, but also this particular nuclear station?
Well, we at Cooper has embarked on the organization to become one of the best in the industry. And we are committed to do that. We are committed to have a site that is reliable, safe, economical, feasible, and having the people that care, the people that understand the facility and the pride of the employees at Cooper Station, there is no doubt in my mind that we'll achieve those goals. You know, when you look at Europe, France, for example, they consider nuclear the first source of energy. The whole country has more reactors than we can have. And they're actually selling power to other countries in Europe. They have 75% of the electricity generated by nuclear. So, again, you know, I wish people would understand that nuclear, you know, is safe, reliable, and it's a clean form of energy. And we just need to take the time in the near future to provide more education to the people that have those concerns. Because I'm a father, and I have no issues bringing my family to a nuclear facility or working in. You know, I know where I work, and I feel extremely comfortable and safe. So I think people need to understand that there is something in their head, but I think we also need to educate the country, and in some cases, they start with the high school kids, and they are promoted.
But again, like Oscar stated, we are all committed in operation, engineering, maintenance, everywhere, that we are committed to safe, reliable operation of this unit.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much.
As we wrapped up our discussion about safety with the Cooper Nuclear Station engineers, directors, and managers, there was one thing that struck me. Site Vice President Oscar Olympias said that a person spending one day at the beach will pick up more radiation from the sun than a person who spent a year at a nuclear power plant. In fact, the exposure to radiation is something they take very seriously and monitor very closely. When we come back, we'll learn more about that, and we'll take you up to the spent fuel pool at the top of the reactor building to learn how they change out old fuel cells for new ones. Stick around.
Support for Spotlight on Industry on KXCV KRNW comes from Nottoway County Economic Development, coordinating economic development services for the City of Maryville, Nottoway County, and the Maryville Industrial Development Corporation. Their services include finance and incentives development, site location, industrial development, and small business assistance. More at maryvillemo.org. And from Mazinga Lake Recreation Park, the park offers residents and visitors camping facilities for tents and RVs, as well as lakeside cabin rentals. Mazinga Lake also offers boating, fishing, hiking, and equestrian trails. More information about Mazingo is at mazingolake.com. Support also comes from the City of Maryville, Missouri, offering residents and visitors opportunities in education, employment, healthcare, and recreation, as well as agricultural, industrial, retail, and professional services. More information about the City of Maryville is at www.maryville.org.
Welcome back to Spotlight on Industry. If you're just joining us, we're taking you inside the walls of the Cooper Nuclear Station in Brownville, Nebraska. Last month, we took you inside the facility's simulator and control room. This month, we bring you something really special. But first, let me refresh your memory on how the fission process works. The Cooper Station uses what is called a boiling water reactor. Uranium fuel pellets that are about the size of the end of your pinky finger are loaded into 14-foot-long hollow tubes called fuel rods. These rods are arranged into 8x8 arrays called fuel assemblies. Well, dozens and dozens of these assemblies are placed inside the water-filled nuclear reactor core. The individual fuel rods are made of a zirconium alloy that allows neutrons to pass through them. Each of the fuel assemblies are separated by control rods that are made of boron. Now, boron is an element that acts like a magnet for neutrons and will not allow them to pass through. These adjustable boron control rods allow the operators to control or stop the fission process. During the fission process, neutrons collide with uranium atoms. This causes the atoms to reach a new energy level and split into two smaller pieces. When they split, they release a tremendous amount of heat energy. This chain reaction and release of heat causes the water inside the reactor to boil and release steam. The steam spins a turbine, which in turn spins a generator, and that creates electricity. The steam is then sent through a pipe that passes through a heat exchanger where it cools and returns to a liquid state. The water is then sent back into the reactor where the process continues. Now, these uranium fuel rods have a life expectancy of about 2 years. After they've done their job, they have to be moved to the spent fuel pool. If you've ever seen pictures of a nuclear plant, you've most likely seen a beautiful aquamarine pool of water that is so clear you can see straight to the bottom of it. That's the spent fuel pool. It sits at the top of the reactor building adjacent to the nuclear core. Every 2 years, the plant gets a new supply of uranium. That will replace a portion of the fuel they have on hand. The spent fuel assemblies are transferred underwater from the reactor core to the spent fuel pool. The new assemblies are then loaded into the reactor. Before we could take a ride to the top of the reactor building, we were issued little devices to clip onto our ID badges called dosimeters. This device would record the amount of radiation that we were exposed to. Safety is of such paramount importance that I also had to remove my jacket because the material that it was made of is prone to pick up naturally occurring radon. Well, we were able to bring our recorders in, but on our way out, we had to put them through a detector to be certain that they did not pick up any unacceptable levels of radiation. We entered an elevator and rode to the top floor of the building. It's a large open room that is about the size of a gymnasium, probably a little bigger. There's a rolling bridge at one end and a large spent fuel pool at the other. The bridge is directly over the reactor core, and it's used to move uranium fuel assemblies from the reactor to the spent fuel pool. The transfer of fuel is a very specialized job that is performed by only a very few qualified individuals. And my tour guides, Drew Niehaus and Dan Goodman, explain the process. Let's listen in.
So what you guys are going to do, these are going to allow you access.
Okay.
Hold yours up. And at some point, you get a green light. Walk through. We're coming from 903 elevation, which is basically ground floor of the reactor building, and where we're heading up is to the top floor, which would be 1001 elevation, and that is the spent fuel pool floor, also known as the refuel floor. It actually has a lot of different names depending on who you really want to talk to. we had talked earlier that we're actually doing some upgrades to our refuel bridge. What looks like an old TV antenna right there is actually that robotic arm that we'll use for refueling and things like that. It's what actually gets inserted down into the pool or down into the reactor with a grapple on the end of it, and that's what lifts up the fuel.
So right now, are we then standing over the reactor?
No. The reactor cavity is underneath, right underneath. See the
circular? The circular area that I see.
That's okay. Correct.
So that's the reactor. And how far below the floor is the reactor?
It's probably a minimum. The core is approximately at 931. So we're talking that with the reactor head, we're probably 50 feet, 40 to 50 feet above the reactor right now.
And so when you change out the rods, we have this robotic arm you mentioned. It's going to be mounted into this bridge that I see. It'll reach down, it'll grab those cores, and then it's going to deposit them into this pool?
Yes, that is correct.
And then how long will it stay in the pool before it can be moved out?
At a minimum, it needs to spend at least 5 years inside the spent fuel pool. At that point, it has decayed off enough that we can actually insert it into the spent fuel storage.
Okay.
And put it in our dry fuel cask, which we have stored on the facility at our dry fuel storage area.
And so all of that spent fuel stays on the property? It doesn't?
No, actually, back in the 80s, we were able to discharge a bunch of our fuel bundles to a facility that processed it.
Okay.
So, and then we've done two campaigns so far to store dry fuel on site, and we can do a full core offload into our pool. And that was one of the requirements that we had to do, is be able to get back to full core offload and have the storage room inside our spent fuel pool.
Okay.
So what Dan's talking about with discharging some of that spent fuel, it's actually in Illinois right now. We had chatted earlier, back in the day, many years ago, the United States actually had plans to reprocess nuclear fuel into usable fuel all over again. Well, GE originally wanted our used fuel to do that and contractually purchased, I believe it's 1,000 spent fuel assemblies from us. Well, contractually, they were obligated to take them, and then they stopped the reprocessing. So GE is actually responsible for 1,000 of our used fuel assemblies in Illinois.
Okay.
Where that lead shield blanket is right now, that area actually becomes like a little passageway full of water. And then on the other side of that block right there where those high radiation signs are at, all that gets flooded up as well.
I see.
We call it flooded to 1,001, but it'll be the same height as the water is right now in the spent fuel pool.
Okay.
And those holes, those are ventilation ducts. So there's air circulating over the spent fuel pool, and right now we keep the spent fuel temperatures about 85 degrees.
Okay.
Just kind of watch your boundary here. But you can see, and we can, it's kind of hard to see get close, but there is, in that far corner, you can see fuel assemblies in the racks. Each one of the, where it's dark, that's a fuel assembly, a spent fuel assembly.
And how far below the surface of the water are those?
It's, if I got my numbers right, it's like 37 feet.
Really?
Yes.
So from the surface of the water to that, where I'm seeing that dark squares, is 37 feet?
Yes, that is correct. And the reason that that is that clear is because it goes back to that hole. This is demineralized water that is ridiculously pure. You can see why, back in the day when nuclear plants were first built, the operators, when they were doing the refuelings or moving these fuel assemblies, were able to use just binoculars to see the serial numbers on the fuel. And it's entirely because the water that we use inside our systems is just so pure.
Is that water radioactive?
Yes.
So you don't want to go for a swim in it?
No.
We don't allow pool parties up here.
No pool parties in the in this room. It is. It's just absolutely ridiculously clear water, and it actually looks really inviting, but maybe not so much.
And then how deep is that? So each one of those cells, you said, is about 14 feet long, right. and we're 37 feet below the surface.
I'm trying to think of my number. I'm trying to think if 37 is right. For some reason, I'm thinking 37 is right.
Yeah.
So, and each one's 14 feet long.
Because basically, when we move it, you have to realize that the assembly being 14 feet long, when we elevate it to move it, we have to have a certain amount of water above it as well. So you're talking close to 20 feet of water above the fuel assembly when we're moving it, and that also provides a great deal of shielding. And like we talked earlier, water is the best shield against radioactivity.
Okay. This floor that is above the reactor, does this floor lift up? Does it slide over?
Shield blocks. So it lifts up. We have shield blocks for each. There's various shield blocks, and that's to help with neutron streaming, which is you get certain paths of neutrons. So there are shield blocks set in the thing to prevent that from occurring, to minimize the dose up here on the floor.
Okay.
So they just take them, and they got designated storage locations. And when it's time to disassemble and do the refueling activities, each one of those blocks goes into a specific spot.
Okay.
On the floor.
Very, very heavy, and we take their moving them very seriously, because when you're dealing with something that is that heavy, there's obvious safety concerns that need to be taken into consideration. So we try to minimize the amount of time people are up here, as well as the number of people that are up here.
Okay. And when people are doing the work up here, are they in full radiation suits?
They're in their anti-seize. We call them anti-seize, and it's contamination protection.
Okay. But again, that comes back to what the course of the work is that they're doing. As you can tell, obviously, we're up here right now, and you're in a t-shirt. So it really depends on what you're doing for the work. The individuals who will be up on the bridge and doing the fuel moves during our refueling outage, they're wearing the anti-seize, and they're in that full white bodysuit, basically.
When you do that swap out of the fuel cells, are there some cells that are ready to come out of this when there are new ones going in?
This summer, we'll get our new shipment of new fuel that will come in from General Electric, and it'll come in, and we load it into the pool. So it's a brand new bundle, and then we'll do basically almost like a one-for-one swap.
So are there fuel assemblies in this water right now that are ready to go to dry storage when you do your next changeover?
That's correct. And our next changeover will be in 2017. We'll do a dry fuel storage campaign in 2017.
And since they're ready, can they come out of that water at that time, or do they always have to be?
We load them. We actually take the cask, put it in the water, load the assemblies into the cask, put the lid on the cask, and then take it out, and then we have to dewater it. There's a special head that goes on it, and it dewaters it. We dry it out, and then we weld it shut.
When new nuclear fuel is delivered to the site, we inspect it very thoroughly. However, the new fuel is not all that radioactive. It's an alpha emitter, and alpha radiation can be blocked with a sheet of paper. That's all you need is shielding. It won't penetrate your skin. So the individuals who do the inspecting of the new fuel, they have white cotton gloves on to prevent the oil from their skin getting onto the fuel assemblies. And that's it, other than the natural PPE like hard hat, safety glasses, things like that. Now, once it goes into the pool, and once it has been in the reactor, it'll never be touched by human hands ever again.
And it'll basically never see the light of day again.
That's correct. Unless, of course, the politics change and we start reprocessing fuel.
I see.
Even though we weren't in any danger of excessive radiation exposure, we didn't spend much time in the spent fuel pool area. As we left, we had to be scanned for radiation. We put our recording equipment and everything in our pockets into a machine called a SAM. That stands for Small Article Monitor. It's a machine that is roughly the size of a dorm-sized refrigerator. The bigger ones, not the small cube-shaped ones. It sits on caster wheels and has a door on both sides of it. The doors are made of lead, and each one weighs 1 ton. While we were waiting for our equipment to be scanned, we were asked to step into another scanner that would detect excessive radiation on our bodies. The machine sort of looks like a large space heater. You have to stand with your feet in a certain position and one arm extending into the machine. Then you hold real still, because if you move, you have to start the scan over. Well, once we passed the inspection, we collected our things and headed back downstairs. We turned in our dosimeters and found out that we were not exposed to much, if any, radiation. In fact, Drew told us that there is more radiation emitted from a decaying banana than what we were exposed to standing atop a nuclear reactor. I'd like to thank my guests this month, Nebraska Public Power District's Drew Niehaus, Oscar Limpius, Dan Goodman, Dan Buman, Khalil Dia, and Kyle Helgenfeld. On a personal note, I'd also like to thank retired U.S. Navy Captain Michael J. Lehman. Captain Lehman is a graduate of Northwest Missouri State University and was a member of the Navy's nuclear community for 27 years. Although you didn't hear his voice on this story, his consultation was immensely valuable to me in my research. Well, please join us next month as we head back into one of our local factories when we tour Maryville Metal Culverts. We'll sit down with company president Ben Bielski to learn how state and local governments are using metal culverts made right here in Maryville to replace our region's aging bridges and infrastructure, thereby making us all safer. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next month as we shine the spotlight on industry.
Support for Spotlight on Industry comes from Nottoway County Economic Development, Mazingo Lake Recreation Park, and the City of Maryville. More information on all of our sponsors is available at MarylandMo.org. Spotlight on Industry is a production of KXCV-KRNW and Northwest Missouri State University. Our editor and producer is Karen Lawrence. For more information about how your company can be featured on Spotlight on Industry, please contact Sam Mason at 660-562-1163.